This episode is proudly sponsored by Everi. Everi is a pioneer and the first of its kind program where the donors and the recipients can choose each other. And that creates a wonderful system for everyone involved and really helps both the donors and the recipients right now, but also helps their families for a lifetime. So check them out at everydonation.com. Are you interested in open egg donation? If you are, you should really tune in today and listen to my guests. They're both from a group called Everi. They have an open donor program, which is really the first of its kind, that allows for frozen or fresh eggs, allows for varying degrees of openness, and also puts in place guardrails to allow you to have the healthiest child possible. So if these things are important to you, please tune in. I think it'll be really fascinating. Welcome to Building Your Family. This is a podcast about fertility treatment, surrogacy, and donor conception, and all the ways the modern family is built. My name is Lisa Schumann. I'm your host, and I am passionate about helping people have a better path to parenthood. And today we have two exciting guests on, Aisha Lewis and Dr. Mark Trollis. Dr. Trollis is the founder and director of the IVF Center in Florida, and he's also a professor at Central Florida College. He's received many, many awards within our industry and outside of our industry through the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, and also is very active within our societies. He's now medical director for Everi, and Aisha Lewis is president of Everi. Her career spans 23 years in third-party reproduction. She's worked passionately to try to help people have a better path to parenthood and to give all the stakeholders a say in the process. And together, they have created this wonderful organization that we're going to tell you about today. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Lisa.
So do you want to tell me a little bit about Everi and how it started and tell everyone what caused you to come to this point in time when nobody else was doing an open donor program? I mean, it's really very, very needed in our industry, but also is new. So it was a very brave move.
Sure, I can start, and I'm sure that Dr. Trollis can jump on in. So Everi was founded because Circle egg donation is part of the North Star family. And Circle has been doing fresh known donations for 25 years and realized that if we were able to branch this out into an egg bank, we would be able to reach more families that could not traditionally afford a fresh donor cycle, but they would have access to the really important benefits that open donation might bring. So that's why Everi was founded. I specifically wanted to join because I was part of a meeting that happened before ASRM in Anaheim, so a couple of years back, where the egg bank industry and members of the donor conceived community have come together and started to talk about common ground. Mm-hmm. And I left that meeting really feeling like some of what they were asking were problems that we could solve. And so when Sam Hyde from North Star reached out and said, I know you have experience in helping to build egg banks. Would you be interested in this? And oh, by the way, it would be predominantly open egg bank. I jumped at that chance. So that's how I came to the table.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. And what about you, Dr. Trollis?
I loved the concept that Aisha shared with me in wanting to be involved in a progressive egg donor bank that prioritized the experience of the recipients and really wanted to optimize every aspect of the care that they provide. It was all about the patient, just accommodating and reducing the anxiety and reassuring them and providing the comfort that they need. It's a big decision to go to the third-party reproduction, as we call it, to use an egg donor. It's not typical. It's not the way you thought your life was going to be. So you really need an agency, an organization that is empathic, that gets your need and your why, and really understands your journey and is there for you and really takes ownership in your problem and is really your advocate. So Everi and North Star fulfilled all of my criteria, as it were, for me to participate, and I'm honored to be their medical director.
That's wonderful. It is so needed. And I think for everyone who's out there, you know, I certainly appreciate that if you're living in an area, in a country, in a state where you don't have access to the donors that you want, or culturally you don't have the choices, sometimes you cannot choose to have an open relationship. But if you're able to do that, what a wonderful gift to give not just the intended parent the opportunity to have medical information, to have contact for themselves, to have contact for the children, but also to give the donor the opportunity to have a say in what happens to her eggs. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and what your experience has been with that?
I'm happy to, because I've been in the industry for so long and we've never had the opportunity to say to a donor, here is an intended parent profile. What do you think? And when I first joined and heard that that's what Circle had historically been doing, and honestly, a lot of agencies who have been helping fresh donor cycles along the way have been doing something similar, I thought, okay, I think we can do it. And my very, very first case on that was just eye-opening, because I had, I don't mind sharing, an intended parent who was fairly young and not sure if she wanted to disclose to her child whether or not egg donation was being used, wrote the intended parent profile, and basically said in this profile, having sitting down, really recognizing that you're going to be reading this has changed the way I'm thinking about this. I want to be the one to tell my child how and when, but I might need you in the future to help me with this story. Hmm. And she went on to document all photographs of the would-be aunts, uncles, grandparents, and great-grandparents. And being able to give that to the donor really brought back the humanity of this process. And it really kind of, it was my aha moment. And okay, this is, we're building a foundation. I don't know where the future is going to hold, but we're building that foundation here. So that was my first experience on the intended parent side. I can tell you from the donor side, I'm just blown away by how many donors who really find the option of having a voice strongly resonate with them, right? They really want to learn more about this. What does this mean? What kind of options do I have? And what I'm finding is most of them, after they learn about all of the opportunities, they really land in this category saying, all, meaning I consider all types of donation, depending on what the intended parents desire initially. And so it's been really eye-opening to see that this is resonating quite strongly with the donor community.
I think the movement came about with disclosure from the donors and also the offspring. You know, in my 20 years or more of doing this, when you mention egg donor or even sperm donor, there is a little bit of a pushback from the parent, because when we talk about disclosure, they're worried that the child is going to want to go to their biological parent, or the biological parent may want to look up the child and have a relationship that could threaten the parent. And it's far from the truth. My personal experience, my wife and I went through infertility for 10 years, and we adopted 5 children. My worry was, and my wife's was, you know, if we go through the adoption process, you know, they're going to want to be involved with the child's life and so on. Or if we tell the child, they're going to want to look up their parent. And that's not the case. It's curiosity. It's wanting to know where you came from. The child is not going to all of a sudden grow up and say, well, that's my real mother, even though you woke up at 3 a.m. and changed my diapers. It's not that at all. And psychologists will echo those comments that disclosure early on to the child is the healthiest, rather than risking a later awareness and mm-hmm. risking betrayal. Right. So you want to have that kind of honesty. And I think this is just, I applaud Avery for being a leader and a groundbreaker in the disclosure world, because it's a win-win for everybody. The donor is comforted to know where their eggs are going. The intended parents are comforted to know from where their eggs are. And then the offspring is getting to know where they want to go. I mean, you know, I mentioned adoption with my children. When we told our children that they were adopted, very, very early on, they said, oh, okay, you know, and then they went on to what they were doing at the time. So you're not going to mm-hmm. lose your child. Disclosure can only empower people to know their roots, as it were, but family are people that grow up in the same home that love each other. That's our credo.
I agree with you 100%. And I also have adopted children. And I think what's really amazing is that, sadly, we didn't really learn from the adoption community, right? In the 1950s, there was a large number of children adopted in the U.S. And we saw over decades that these adult adoptees said, I wish that I had known early in life. I wouldn't have had identity confusion. It would have been nicer to know my birth parent. And now being able to give birth parents the ability to choose their adoptive parents is so important. And so sadly, we didn't learn that in the donor conception community until now. And even still now, it's slow. It's been a very slow change. And I think that it's difficult for a lot of these groups that have not been able to be open like you've been, because what we're seeing now, as you know, in England, we're now seeing this first wave of children who are born from donor conception being able to search. And it's very confusing for them and very difficult. And the donors keep wondering, well, this child is supposed to reach out to me at 18, but could it be Monday? Could it be Wednesday? Is it going to be in 5 years? Is it going to be in 3 years? And there's been all this secrecy and shame around it for 18 years. And then all of a sudden, they have to just, you know, in a snap of a finger, be available to the recipients and be available to the offspring. And they've created their family not knowing that this was going to even happen in that way. And they have to now, 18 years later, tell their family members or their friends that they haven't told. And everything is just, they're scrambling to kind of catch up. For you, you're starting at the beginning where everybody can plan from day one. Is this going to work for me? Is this going to work for this group of people, not just for the recipient, but also for the child and for the donor, to make sure that that donor is someone who's going to feel comfortable sharing with other people, is going to feel comfortable with outreach?
Look at the growing popularity of the donor sibling registry. People want to know from where they came. I'll tell you a story about a patient. I was doing an embryo transfer. It was a Saturday morning. I'll never forget this. And right after the transfer, we were talking, and the patient said, Dr. T, could you just please make sure that you do not share this with my OB-GYN? I said, what do you mean? Well, I don't want the OB-GYN to know this was egg donation. And, you know, she was in her 40s, and you do want to let the OB-GYN know that, because the screening is based on your chronologic age and risk of Down syndrome and so on and so forth. So I said, well, why do you not want to share? Because I don't want, so she said, I don't want the OB-GYN to know the baby isn't mine. And I was frozen by that comment. I'll never forget that. And I says, you know, I said, can we talk? I said that, you know, this baby is going to be looking at you as mom, 150%. And that really is the way that you need to take a look at and embrace this child. Because this is the way you're growing your family. So we have our patients see a reproductive health counselor on our staff. And I always tell them that, look, if you have hesitancy, if you have concerns over whether that is going to be your child, you really should hold off on doing this until you embrace that option.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I can lend a story on the other side of it with donors too. So we had a case where the donor had donated previously in a fresh cycle, somebody somewhere else, was in our egg bank. So obviously had gone through the normal screening parameters, met with the psychologist. We do mutual matching, where I had mentioned that IP creates the profile and says, I'd like to use this donor. And in this situation, in what we call a fully known scenario, meaning we're going to be meeting and we're going to be exchanging identifying information right off the bat. And so she agreed to that, and they had the Zoom meeting. And then she came back to her coordinator and said, that made that really real for me, and I don't want to do this anymore. And my team said, oh, wow. And I took this as a, this is actually why we do this.
Yes.
Right now, this is why we do this, right? We took something that was abstract. She really got to see the reality of it. She made an informed decision. We respect it, right? We respect that. And this family really wanted a fully known donor. Had she gone through with it and then went MIA, that family would be at the deficit here. So yes. This is exactly why I count this as a win in our book, because we're really trying to make this full circle so people go in with as fully informed consent as possible.
And also, we don't want the donor to regret it one day, right?
Absolutely.
That she's going to regret, when I've screened donors, we've all talked to them about how important it is that they think about thinking far ahead in the future. Are you going to feel comfortable sharing this with other people? What if you don't get pregnant yourself one day? Are you going to regret having done this? Are you going to want to speak to the offspring? I mean, there's so many things that the donors really should be prepared for. And I think you take it a lot more seriously when you know that this is real, that you're really going to meet this person or really going to have a relationship with them. I find that when you go through ovum donations, so often it can feel like, at least the patients that I used to see, that you're just going through this medical process. Then when you see the faces of these people whose lives you're changing, now all of a sudden, it's a different story. Now you feel invested in a different way.
We try to counsel the donors that anonymity is truly dead, and we let them know that there's a likelihood that you're going to be disclosed, but it might not even be you that finds out that information. It could be your children. It could be your relatives. And so we want to empower them with knowing the outcomes of their treatment cycle so that they can navigate their own story and really start to conceptualize, how do I put these pieces together? When do I tell my own children that I did this? You know, what do I have to tell my family? And so these are conversations that, you know, we hope to even broaden with the mental health professional group community as we support the donor as she actually starts to conceptualize, you know, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, what are the pieces of the puzzle she needs to put into place to navigate her family through this?
And if she's feeling prepared for that and feeling good about it, then she's less likely to be anxious when she's contacted, right? She's going to be much more comfortable when somebody contacts her for medical information or if they want to stay in touch or the child has, you know, for emotional reasons, a desire to reach out to her. So that's really wonderful for everybody all around. So could you take us through the process a little bit and how that works? Let's say a recipient comes to you and says, I'd like to be matched with a donor. How does the process work at Everi?
You will actually go to our website. That's where our donor database is. And we have both fresh and frozen donors. So you can see if there's frozen eggs available on a donor or if she's just a fresh cycle donor. The donor gets to make that decision. It will also tell you the types of donation that that donor is open to doing. So fully known, semi-known, ID release, or de-identified with a future change to ID release if the IPs want that. So if I were an IP, I would look and I would identify a donor and have some conversations about what type of donation cycle is right for our family. And then we would match and we would have basically two things happen at the same time. One, the information of the donor would be sent to the clinic of the IP so that they can review genetics and other medical information to determine if this is suitable for the clinic's criteria. And two, the intended parent completes a profile, as much or as little as they want, but it needs to be non-identified, letting the donor know that they'd like to match with them and the type of donation cycle that they'd like to match with. This gets presented to the donor, and the donor either agrees or disagrees, but normally agrees. And in cases of fully known or semi-known, where they're going to be meeting, we facilitate that meeting. It's usually via Zoom. And then legal agreements will still be drawn up, even an egg bank cycle for a fully known or semi-known, because that contact has happened. Mm-hmm. And so we will have legal agreements. And then we proceed with the cycle, either, you know, fresh cycle or shipping out of the oocytes. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
That's wonderful. So let's say someone creates embryos, and I'm assuming that you're really thinking through this, all these pieces, because it sounds like you've got every angle covered here. But let's say someone creates embryos and they're not using all the embryos. Is the donor then notified if they're going to donate the embryos elsewhere?
Yes. And the donor can even say, and it's counsel to think about this, that, you know, what they would agree or disagree to in terms of embryo at that point. So maybe they say, you know, I'm not comfortable with the embryos being adopted out, or I want to be notified. And some of them might say, it's okay, you can do what you'd like to do with these embryos, just as long as I'm made aware of what happens. But they have a say in that, and that's part of the reason for the legal agreements.
If you've been watching me for a while, you know that I feel strongly about planning ahead, particularly when it comes to donor conception. With Everi, you have the ability to have so many choices to think ahead. To store it, you can use frozen eggs, you can use fresh eggs, you can use a known donor, you can use somebody that you're just going to be in touch with for medical information. But what's so important is that you get to choose your donor and she gets to choose you. And that's fantastic because you will have the ability later to reach out to her for medical information. Or if your child's interested for social reasons, you have so many choices with Every. It's really fantastic to be able to now finally have the choices that will be important to you and your future children. So check them out, everydonation.com. I think you'll really love them. So you mentioned genetic screening. So the genetic screening is part of your intake process before you match with a recipient.
That's correct. So at Every, once a donor applies, she can apply to learn about all aspects of our program. That includes fresh, frozen, and types of donation. One of the first few things that we do before they're presented either as a fresh match to IPs or entered into the egg bank, it is the genetic carrier screening, along with AMH, PsychSocial, and Engaged MD, which is a medical learning module, so they really understand the egg donation process.
That's great. And what about the full psychological screening? Are all the donors screened psychologically?
Yep, they are. So they're screened with the ASRM guidelines, so the psychologists have to meet ASRM guidelines as well, and we're doing a PAI. And then we're trying to build out some tools that are going to be supportive tools for the donor as she completes the journey on the other side post-donation. So we really want this to be as full spectrum as possible.
That's fantastic. So people really get a fully screened donor before they match with anyone.
But it's also, I just wanted to add that it's also important for the intended parents to have that kind of a education session. It's not much of a screen,
yes.
Is it? It's just to really inform about the process, what they can expect, but also emphasizing the importance of disclosure early on.
Yes.
And making them understand that it's important to resolve the fact that this is how you're building your family. The more transparency and the more acceptance of that, much more healthier family upbringing.
Yes.
I think we're doing a really good job at this point in time as an industry and listening to some of the voices of the donor-conceived community, like Melissa Lindsay at DCC just got that ASRM grant to have some educational materials that we can draw upon that can really help inform donors and intended parents to think forward. And hey, we can't speak on behalf of the donor-conceived, but we can listen to them and present their varied experiences to both parties so that they can really internalize that. And then I think we can make a fully informed decision, both the IPs and the donors. But by understanding that there's this third entity that's not represented right now,
correct. Mm-hmm.
But has voices and has varied opinions and just having knowledge of what those might be.
Yes. And also, I'd like to add that I think because of what you're saying, that so many in the donor-conceived community and also the public now, having heard all of this, gets very anxious, both with sperm and egg donation, thinking that this is this deep, dark hole that I'm going into. And I don't know what to do or how to navigate it. And yet I don't feel comfortable with my physician or my bank because I don't know what I'm getting. And you probably have also heard that there's lots of discussion about not having like a chain of custody, not knowing where the eggs are coming from or where the sperm is coming from, not knowing if there's correct psychological screening or genetic screening. And all of these difficulties are making people very, very anxious. And so I think by making everything really transparent is great. But at the same time, what's wonderful is that you're following ASRM guidelines and making sure the best medical care is not forgotten, which, you know, brings up another thought that I had, which is really wonderful and really hard to do, which is to be able to make sure that you have some history, which we discussed earlier. And I know that there's been a push for donors not to provide a history because sometimes they don't always know, or sometimes there is someone who is adopted or donor conceived themselves and doesn't have the information. But many recipients want to have that genetic background, that health background from the donor. And so I know that's a really tough thing to think about because you have to recruit a smaller number of people if you're really looking for people with full medical histories, but somehow you're able to do that.
It's a big funnel, like you had mentioned, but it is important to us, and Dr. Trullos can speak on this because he defined the eligibility criteria, that the donors have access to 3 generations of their family medical background history. And it's also important for us because we know that donors are self-reporting, and it's not that they're not being honest, but they might not know the full nature of that medical history, and we're aware of that. We try to do one better and have our genetics counselors actually elicit that history. So they self-report, and then our genetic counselors are obtaining that pedigree as well. And it's really interesting, and Dr. Trullos can talk about this, some of the correlations that they can make that end up in rule outs that maybe we wouldn't have ruled out, or maybe even ruled in that we wouldn't have ruled in based on what they can see in this bigger, broader picture of symptoms, ages, and genetic histories. And so I'm really glad that they're part of that process. They remain to be it even afterwards once we get updates from the donor.
You know, I tell the intended parents that they're going to know more about the donor than they are their significant other. And for first-time intended parents, which is usually the case, they are very, very concerned about all of this background, the genetics, the medical, and for generations. And I say, you know, did you ask your partner all those questions before you started to try to have a child? And that sometimes can be overwhelming and delay the process over their fears that may not really come into play. Where we can provide them with really good information is the genetic screening. Hundreds of genetic carrier testing is done. So you get all these genes that live on chromosomes, right? And these genes are our DNA, make us what we are. Many people are carriers of certain diseases. They're carriers, doesn't mean they have the disease, right? So if the donor is a carrier, and if we're using an egg donor, and the male partner is a carrier, then there is a 1 in 4 risk that the embryo would have the disease. And some of these diseases can be life-threatening. So that's the area that you really want to get involved with for the concerns about inheritable risks to baby. Family history of diabetes or even heart disease and things like that, I mean, you know, there is not that absolute genetic link as it is to the mutations that we're talking about. You know, everybody wants an absolutely clean history, as it were, but that's unlikely. So you sort of have to prioritize the risks and see what you're willing to accept and what's a hard stop, as it were.
Those things are so important, I think, for patients to be able to decide for themselves. Right, because of course, if they could use their own gametes to reproduce, they would. But since they can't, at least now they feel like they have some control over the choice of the genetics for their future child, because it's so difficult. It's hard, as Dr. Follis, you and I both know, not being genetically connected to your children is a big step, right? It's a big step to feel like you don't know the genes of your children. And it's not what people usually, except for Angelina Jolie. I think she's the only person I know who had a non-genetically related child first. Usually people try to have genetically related children first. So if you can't, it is a big step. And so I think it does bring people a lot of comfort to know that they're choosing genes that are going to provide them with the healthiest possibility.
But the best thing about not having biologically related children is that you could brag about them forever, and because they got nothing from you. You know, so you're not saying, they did this well, they do this because I do this. You've done nothing. This is their innate, wonderful, wonderful, miraculous qualities that do that. I just want to insert a little editorial or editorial, I think is a better word, about PGT, which is pre-implantation genetic testing. That's a pervasive test in many, many centers across the country and the world. And for the viewers, it's where the embryos are, some cells are taken from the embryo, sent to a specialized laboratory. The embryo's frozen, waiting for the genetic information to come back. And these are chromosome tests of the embryo in general, although you can do the genetic testing that we talked about earlier if both parties are carriers. There is no good evidence to support doing PGT when you're using an egg donor. So if you are an intended parent that are watching this, I just want to share with you that would be an add-on or an upcharge, as it were. There really is nothing gained by doing genetic testing. It doesn't improve the per-embryo transfer pregnancy rate or lower the miscarriage rate in that age group. So egg donors are not ones that you would want to spend the money to do that kind of testing. Some people are very, very interested in gender. You do get gender from that testing, but you have to be careful that if there is nothing gained in the egg donor group, is the testing then causing any type of damage to the embryo? And also the report that the embryo is abnormal in a low percentage, but a real percentage, it may be a false positive. So you could be discarding an embryo that otherwise would have implanted. So in general, we do not advise women, certainly below 35, to be doing chromosome testing to improve the outcome.
When the recipients come to you, you're matching them. So they're going to make these decisions once they get to their clinic, right? They'll have to make that kind of decision.
For many of them, they still do decide to go forward. So from a frozen egg perspective, most of the egg banks have a guarantee of having at least one usable blastocyst. We do know that PGTA for a portion of our patients is still going to happen despite recommendations. And so we offer a euploid guarantee. What was really interesting in our very first cases was a clinician coming back and saying we had two blasts. One was aneuploid, one was low-level mosaic. We would transfer a low-level mosaic and so would our the patient, but we want to make sure it doesn't negate the guarantee. And I thought, oh, that's a very interesting question. So what we decided was we don't want to interfere with the clinician's decision or the patient's decision. Go ahead and transfer that and it won't negate the guarantee. In fact, because you're now taking on potential risk of miscarriage, it's going to become a delivery guarantee. So if you don't deliver, then you get that cohort back or another cohort so that you can try again. But these are the questions that, you know, from the clinical side, the medical side, they also have, how does this operate here on the business side? And we really want to be complementary.
That's wonderful. That's great. And then, so you're also appreciating everybody's decision and their feelings about this. And what about, we started to talk a little bit about the screening process and how you go through this. How is the donor, how is she counseled in terms of these screenings? Because of course, she's going to potentially discover things about herself that maybe she doesn't know, right, in the screening. And that can be kind of a tricky subject too, if she has psychological issues, which I have seen many times, or if she has a heritable genetic trait, then she's going to have to deal with that. So how do all of you manage that within your program, or do you refer out for those sorts of cases?
All of the donors have a pretty lengthy consultation with the donor intake team, which are specialized coordinators that actually speak to this about what does screening entail? What are we going to be doing? What are we going to be learning about? And specifically, agreeing to be a donor is potentially finding out information about yourself that can impact your own quality of life now that you know it. And are you okay with that? Mm-hmm. So they do sign a screening acknowledgement form. And there is a very strong genetic component of that. Like, this is what we're doing, genetic care screening. Other screenings too, because believe it or not, the genetic counselors can make some insights that they might have to action. I've seen this where you just told me about your medical history. I have in front of me your carrier screening. I'm seeing some stuff here that needs follow-up. And so now, you know, they have to go back and kind of...
That's great.
Yeah. So we want them to be as informed as possible about that. They also go to their clinician, right? We don't do all of the medical screening just by us. The doctors that we work with are doing it as well. And Dr. Trollis can speak more eloquently than I on that. But they're doing this as well.
Yeah, we follow the FDA guidelines. I mean, it's required for programs in the United States. And at that point, it's not really going to be a major disclosure to the recipients, because we do infectious disease screening, HIV, hepatitis B and C, syphilis, and then we do the physical examination. It really is meant, the questionnaire is as well meant to reduce the risk of transmission, viral transmission, to the embryo, and then of course theoretically to mom. Although the concerns are probably more theoretical in a lot of circumstances, we still do a lot of that and physical examination. But one area that the clinician is very in tune with is the ovarian age testing. You know, the best prognosis is the younger the patient chronologically. Biologically, we start looking at the numbers of eggs that they have left, and that could be determined from a hormone test called AMH or anti-Müllerian hormone, and also ultrasound, looking at the little baby cysts on the ovary that represent eggs, okay? That gives us an idea about how many eggs they're going to get, not a fertility potential. There's a terrible misconception, if you will, about this ovarian age testing. It doesn't tell you that you're going to get pregnant naturally or even with artificial insemination, but it does give you an idea about how many eggs you're going to get. And when you're doing egg donation, you really want to be able to get a reasonable number of eggs to help those intended parents. And if they have a very low AMH level or very low and or very low what we call an antral follicle count, which are those little cysts on the ovary by ultrasound, then they're really not going to be the best donor for intended parents. And that's what we look at clinically as well.
And that's so important to know because it's in so many known donor relationships, the patients get very attached to the donor. And then they find out this donor is not a good candidate. And sometimes they want to go forward with her anyway. And it just becomes a big heartbreak for everyone.
It gets to be costly. So, other thing, of course, cigarette smoking in the donor is not a good idea because of the lower number of eggs that you're going to get. Even vaping is a concern as well. And of course, recreation drugs and alcohol are not accepted. You can educate as best as you can, but we really want to try to provide them, the intended parents, the best donor options so that they can not just select the best donor, but give them their best opportunity for a baby.
So now I have a very big question for you, and that is regarding donor limits. So there are lots of discussions going around, you know, in our society, but also in the donor conceived community about family limits. I had someone on my podcast who had a really interesting idea about software so that we could track donors and donations, which also I think would be very helpful to everyone because that way we could make sure that we know where everything is, where all these gametes are going. But since we don't have that at this moment, even with a contract, we can't guarantee people that you're only going to have 2 or 4 or 8 other offspring. But certainly, I think if you know the person, right, if you meet the donor, it's much more likely, I think, to be honest with somebody and to hold a promise to someone who you've met rather than someone who you haven't met. So I think that this is another benefit that you have there at Evry, because if you meet your donor and she says, I'm only going to donate a few times, it's more likely that that's going to happen, I think, if you know each other. What are your thoughts about that?
I have a few. We actually allow the donor to set her own limits as well, right? I think after you really counsel a donor about, okay, in the Evry program, a fresh donation is a one-to-one donation, meaning all of the eggs in that first cycle are going to go to that recipient. In a frozen, it can be more. It's probably going to be 2, 3, 4. And I doubt it. We don't try to get as many eggs as possible, but we want a nice even cycle. But I want to counsel them on that because they need to make decisions down the road.
Yes.
How many times do they want to cycle? Because we want to be transparent and we want to let them know you're going to be navigating all of this in the future. And I think that's when it becomes really real. Okay, maybe I'm going to help 3 families and I've got 3, or I'm going to do 5 egg bank cycles. Are you really telling me that I might actually have, you know, 15 different donor conceived individuals plus reach out? And so I think that becomes real. And I think we need to be responsible, all of us, in talking to the donors about that. The intended parents can request and have requested the same thing. Right. And say in this legal agreement, I'd like to put a limit in this because it's important to me that if my donor conceived child wants to reach out and find others conceived via the same gametes, they're not stuck with trying to find dozens, if not hundreds of those that might have been created with those gametes. That's just my 2 cents.
Mm-hmm. And you're probably seeing more and more of that happening. And that is something that is very different from what we went through, Dr. Trellis, with adoption. But in egg or sperm donation, you certainly can have many more offspring. And is everyone that you're seeing comfortable with these ideas? Do you feel that the recipients and the donors feel comfortable with this idea that they would like to try their best to limit the family size?
absolutely had donors who decided not to do an egg bank cycle for that very reason. And so they'll just be a fresh donor. And we have seen intended parents request that the donor only, you know, do a couple of cycles and want us to, you know, really have that conversation. So we're seeing it.
There is no corollary for the sperm donor. No limitation on that. You know, the years ago, it was thought of consanguinity risks, the more that donors will donate in a particular community. But now, eggs are being shipped all over the country. So the chance of consanguinity, where close relations, first-degree relatives, can conceive a child, is much more less risky for that reason. So, but right now, that's still in place.
It is. And there's been some recent articles in the public sphere that have actually highlighted, you know, how some of this has impacted. There was one that actually said, I accidentally had a relationship with my, you know, half brother.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago.
Just came out. Yeah.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think we've still got a lot to discuss in this community on how do we navigate and specifically educate our donors and our intended parents so they can make those decisions.
Yes. And certainly, you know, if you have two families, I know of two families, it was published in Fertility and Sterility like 15 years ago, where there were two families in a small town in New York, and they used the same egg donor, and by sheer coincidence, they used the same sperm donor. So these children are going to be in the same kindergarten, one school district, and grow up together. And so, and it probably happens more frequently than we know about. So it is really important. Even with the ASRM limits are pretty large. And considering that we have so many frozen embryos in this country that are creating children who are born decades after the embryo was created, it can be, you know, potentially problematic, I think, still. So I think more and more people are worried about that, and more people are thinking about it and wanting to limit the family size. But you're saying the donors also are interested in that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's great.
When you really break it down to them about disclosure is likely, and then they start to realize, okay, well, if I do this six times and I've done it to an egg bank cycle, what's that number, potential number that I actually have to prepare for or potentially prepare for? And so I think it really is all about trying to get everybody to think 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And once we can kind of get them to think like that, the decision-making process, I hope, becomes easier for everybody.
Yes, I agree. Well, it sounds like you're crossing every T and dotting every I and trying to make sure that all of those things go so well. My hat's off to you.
Well, thank you. We really welcome feedback from all members of the community, you know, especially the donor conceived. We believe that they should have a seat at this table and tell us all of their experiences so that we can make our programs better. And the same is true for the donors and the intended parents. We're just building programs to support them.
Just before I let you go, I just was curious, are you finding any donors and recipients interested in co-parenting agreements within your group?
I haven't yet. Have you, Dr. Trollis?
No, I've never heard that.
Have you? That's interesting.
Yes, I'm seeing more and more of them. I have been for a long time now, seeing more and more co-parenting agreements. Usually it's with someone that they know, an old friend from college or somebody that they're friendly with. But even when you're in a situation where there's a known donor and let's say, you know, a lesbian couple wants to have this single man in their life and maybe in their child's life a little bit, and they decide that they want to have this relationship with a man who maybe can be representative, not of a father, but maybe an uncle figure or someone else who will be that role model for them or somebody else in their life. I'm seeing more and more of that happening. And unfortunately, and I think this is where you all come in so nicely, is unfortunately it's happening a lot on social media. So people are meeting each other on Facebook and all over social media and trying to create these known donor relationships when there's no guardrails in place.
There's no experience how to actually navigate through. Yeah.
So there's no, you know, genetic testing ahead of time or psychological screening or any of that. And then unfortunately, I think people are so eager to build their families that sadly they may end up in these problematic situations down the line. So I think it's great that you're able to merge both of those things, the known relationships and the emotional, psychological importance of having that connection, but also keep those medical guardrails in place that are so important.
Yes, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for coming today. I think this is a good place to wind down. Where can people find you?
Well, our website is www.everydonation.com, but you can also just Google Every Donation or the North Star Fertility Group, and you'll get to us eventually.
Okay, terrific. I want to thank you so much for coming today. I really appreciate your time. And for all of you out there, thank you so much for listening to us. This is an evolving world that we're all part of. And I think Every is doing a beautiful job of trying to make changes that will help everybody involved. So thank you so much. Reach out to them at every.com and reach out to me at familybuilding.net anytime. And please subscribe because that's how we keep going. And I'll see you next time. Hi, it's Lisa Schumann, just popping in quickly to say thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked it, please rate, review, and subscribe because that's how we keep going and come back for more.